This is London Calling.
Hi, I'm Graham Mack, and coming up, part two of my chat with the drummer from the Stray Cats, Slim Jim Phantom.
I always go back to, like, when I was 17 years old, walking to my drum lesson, and you would stop me at the crossroads and said, 40 years later, you're going to have played with Jerry Lee, toured with the Stones, lived in London, hung out with the rock royalty in London, and, like, been able to go. Still, I can go anywhere in London. I know London, like, the, you know, taxi driver, you know, to go, and I'm pretty much welcome everywhere, and sign this in blood. Will you take this life right now? Of course.
More from Slim Jim Phantom on the way, a look at what's happening in Britain this week, and what's on your mind, Ken?
Oh, I just think this attack in Barcelona was so sick and depraved.
Isn't it awful? And you gotta remember, they don't think, the people who did it don't think it's sick and depraved. They think they were doing the right thing.
Have.
You are?
They do not have the values we have. They're not civilized people.
Well, they interpret the words of their scripture in a strange way. They, for some reason, need to have these words written down and passed down over thousands of years and translated hundreds of times. They need those words to live by for some reason. And it's just a bit, well, it's not right.
Human life is sacred. It really is.
Yeah. All life is, really, you know, unless it's for survival. It's hard. We can't get our heads around it. It's just, and it achieves absolutely nothing except more hatred and prejudice against them and against people who believe in the teachings of that religion, who have nothing to do with this and who are just as appalled, but it breeds prejudice against anyone of the Islamic faith.
Well, to me, the people actually perpetrate the crime are sad, lonely men who've got no life.
Yeah, usually, yeah. Yeah. You
know, they want something to believe in. They cannot hold a relationship. They're sad losers.
They need, but it seems to be that particularly men need to belong to some kind of tribe or gang. And yeah, we've seen it with so-called football hooligans. We see it with, it's just this need in men to belong to something and to fight for something and to have an enemy. And I don't know why that is. And the people who do this want to belong to this particular branch of Islam. But it brings hate and prejudice to all of Islam. So it actually hurts their cause.
And they can't see that.
I don't know what it is. And I don't know how it's going to change. But, you know, I have my own views on religion. Religion is respected for some reason. When believing in an imaginary friend, somebody in the sky who is reading your thoughts and who makes all the rules. I mean, look at the Ten Commandments. Rape is not in the Ten Commandments. Only two of the commandments are law, which is thou shalt not kill and thou shalt not steal. And really, until somebody put on there, killing is bad, they all went, really? I didn't know it's bad, is it? Okay. You don't need that. You know killing is bad. So I don't understand the need for people to have a belief, a faith, a religion. I don't understand that. And so then to take it to extremes where in the name of your faith, you will go and kill innocent people. I really don't know how it gets to that stage. And I don't know why these beliefs are respected. And it's the tolerance paradox. You know, we say we must be tolerant of people's beliefs. But if their belief is to throw gay people off buildings just for being gay, you know, by being tolerant of their beliefs, you're being intolerant of the rights of someone's freedom to, you know, it's the tolerance paradox. And I think we're actually, in a lot of ways, too tolerant of religion in some ways. You're not supposed to, in fact, me saying this, you know, ridiculing religion will get complaints. I don't know why because religion is ridiculous. But by and large, it helps people. I mean, obviously, there are major problems, but this branch of it and taking it to this extreme, it's just hard to work out where the good in that is. Why they think this is a good thing to do, why they need to do this. It's just, I don't know what the answer is. You know what the answer, can you think of any way to fix this, Ken?
Well, I don't. I mean, you know, if you look back to the civil wars in Britain, you know, between Catholics and Protestants.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Eventually we overcame it in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully good will win out.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the meantime, I think it's up to all the good people of Islam, Muslims.
Yeah.
To preach to them the good side of it, and not the hatred.
Yeah, yeah. And to also come out and condemn this kind
exactly.
of thing. Yeah, yeah.
Perhaps we're too tolerant here. Perhaps we should allow the burqa to be worn, allow halal meat to be made, and that, you know.
Well, we do. Both of those we do. Both of those things we allow.
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't know what the answer is. It's just every time this happens, it's like, oh, please, come on.
If they're taunting the world.
Yeah.
I don't know.
All right.
I don't know what the answer is, but hopefully good will win out.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ken.
Take care, Graham. Bye-bye.
Cheers, mate. Ta-da.
Britain is the greatest country on earth, and that's because nothing is your fault. If you smoke, it's because the National Health Service won't pay for your nicotine patches. If you drink too much, it's because there aren't warning labels on the bottles and cans. If you're fat, it's because there's no sugar tax, or your doctor's fat, or the NHS won't pay for your gym membership. And if your kids are fat, well, it's because the manufacturers put too many calories in their food. Now, to make sure you don't get the idea that anything could possibly be your fault, the government are constantly looking for other people for you to blame. Health officials are now demanding that calories in popular foods must be cut. Targets are going to be set to reduce calories in pizzas, burgers, and ready meals. It's part of the government's drive to tackle childhood obesity. Finally, the government is going to do something about your fat kids. The size of products will be reduced and ingredients will be changed in food bought in supermarkets, takeaways and restaurants. The targets will be set by Public Health England, which is an executive agency of the Department of Health. The targets will be voluntary, but if the food industry doesn't respond, the government say they're prepared to legislate. So, more great news and a reminder that if you have fat kids, it's not because you're feeding them too much bad food. It's all the government's fault for not having calorie targets. So, keep feeding your fat little darlings whatever they want, whenever they want. Have another cigarette. Get drunk. Don't exercise. Maybe even take up a new addiction. Have you tried heroin? And if it becomes a problem, don't worry. You're not to blame. Because this is the greatest country on earth. And even if it isn't, it's still not your fault. Let's cross now to rural North Yorkshire. Rolling green hills, rain and sheep. A county that always reminds me of when I used to live in New Zealand. Jane's there, and what have you been up to, Jane?
I was in Glasgow this weekend with one of my old girlfriends.
Mm.
I can say old now because we're getting there. But she lived in New Zealand for ages.
Did she? Whereabouts? Do you know?
No.
Mm-hmm.
And I've forgotten that bit.
Okay.
But I said, oh, well, I was telling about you in the radio show. She said, does he remember Leggy Peggy?
Leggy Peggy, no.
On the radio.
No. Which...
And she was this old dear and was on a late night show. And she'd phoned in and she'd play the piano. Phone. Every night. Tony said, I went to bed with Leggy Peggy every night.
I don't remember that, no. I remember Kevin Black was on Radio Howrackey and he did a syndicated show called The Other Top 40 on the weekends. He was a big deal, Kevin Black. The funniest thing I heard on the radio in New Zealand, I was listening to Radio Northland in Whangarei, and the DJ had just played a Billy Idol tune. This was in the 80s. He's played White Wedding on one of the big ones. And he goes, yeah, that was Billy Idol from London, and he used to be in a band called Generation 10. And you know Billy Idol used to be in Generation X. The kids read it as a Roman numeral. The Met Office is getting even worse at predicting the weather. Right now, it's pouring down in the southeast of England. And it's on days like these every year that I go back and look at the forecast that the Met Office issued 3 months ago, promising us the hottest and driest summer on record. Well, I don't have to go back that far. This is from yesterday's Daily Mail. Summer returns to Britain tomorrow as Hurricane Gert brings Caribbean air and 82 degrees Fahrenheit heat, making the country hotter than Mexico and Greece. Honestly, Met Office, get your act together. You get all this information from satellites and weather balloons. It's constantly updated. You've got a full-time staff of over 1,500 people and a budget of $219 million a year, and you still can't get it right. And you know that massive supercomputer that cost the British taxpayer $125 million? Well, you might want to turn it off and turn it back on again, because it isn't working! Great story this week from Lancashire about a couple who were getting married and their wedding photographs were photobombed by about 200 Vikings. Yeah, that particular Saturday afternoon was when they were having a reenactment of some Viking, I don't know, rape and pillage, whatever it was that Vikings did. So, great story, though, for the wedding. You got a wedding story for me. Who's this?
Hello, Graham, Matt. It's Andy. I've got a wedding story for you.
Yeah, what happened?
I was the best man at a wedding down in Eastbourne.
Mm-hmm.
And the strange thing was the registry office is right next door to the police station.
Right.
And when we came out the registry office, the chauffeur walked up to the guy that got married and went, sorry, I can't start the car, the keys jammed.
Right.
So, and they all looked at me and they went, oh, you're from East London, you should be able to break into the car properly.
Oh, no.
So there was me, legs sticking out the back of the car, trying to hotwire this car outside the police station at Eastbourne.
Did the cops pay any attention?
Oh, yeah, they came out and gave me a hand.
The cops helped you hotwire a car.
Yeah.
Did you get it going?
Oh, yeah, finally got it sorted out. The police was cheering, everybody was taking pictures, and I think it was part of the first photo in the photo album, I think.
Brilliant wedding story. Hey, thanks, mate.
No worries.
The things politicians think are important are usually different to the things that the people who voted for them think are important. The bongs of Big Ben in Westminster have sounded for the final time for 4 years. The clock's being repaired. Members of Parliament gathered outside the Houses of Parliament on Monday to mark the occasion of the bell's final chimes. In New Palace Yard, around 200 parliamentary staff watched the bell bong. MP Stephen Pound wiped a tear from his eye. He said, "This is a desperately sad moment, and you don't know what you've got till it's gone." He described it as a moment of somber sadness. Oh, please. Get a grip! It's just a bell! When tourists come here, they don't record the sound of the bell. They take photographs of the tower. The tower's going nowhere. It's still going to be there, right next to Westminster Bridge. It's just the sound of a bell. Now, this would be big news if the year was 1822, but we don't need Big Ben to tell the time anymore. We've all got clocks on our wrists or in our pockets now. more MPs showed up to hear the last chimes of Big Ben than made the 5-mile journey across town to Grenfell Tower, where at least 80 people died in a fire trapped in their homes. Did Stephen Pound shed a tear for them? Making the sound of a bell in London into a big issue when thousands of people are about to lose their jobs as we Brexit the EU, the National Health Service is in crisis, and when there's extra security fears just days after the attack in Barcelona, is either plain silly or a desperate attempt to redirect attention away from the stuff that really matters. We got another example of bad parenting this week. There's a tourist attraction in the south of England, and one of the things they've got there is an 800-year-old sarcophagus. It was pulled out of the ground many years ago, even had a skeleton inside it, and it's on display. Well, some parents took their little darling to go and have a look at it, and they lifted the kid over the barrier and sat him on the 800-year-old coffin so they could take a picture of him. Anyway, it wobbled, it fell over and smashed. Security have got pictures of the family on CCTV as they ran away together. What bad parenting have you seen? Jackie.
It's got to be the people, the parents that think that, you know, that they will not respond if their child kicks off.
Oh, yeah.
In a public place.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, no, we'll just let them, they'll cry themselves out. They'll scream themselves out. We'll just ignore them. That's fine, but what about all the people that are around you who want to actually strangle your child because it's making so much noise and you're not reprimanding it? How is it going to know that right's from wrong if you let them self-soothe or whatever they call it?
Now, we say this, and we see it all the time, of parents who just don't look like they're doing the job. The kids are just doing whatever they want.
Yeah.
But don't the kids normally turn out okay? You know, when you think about, you know, and I've got nieces and nephews and, you know, and I've seen things and I think, well, tell the, but you know what? The kids turned out just fine. How important is it?
I think so. But because things have changed so much that we are in a real, real danger of the fact that, do you know what I mean, the way that the world and everything has changed and the way that children are brought up by the next generation that's not, say, our generation, they didn't have the discipline. So, you know, the standards drop across the board because they don't.
But if you look at say crime figures over the last 50 years, crime has gone down. So we must be producing better human beings.
That's because they're spending their life texting and playing Xbox.
But they're not stealing Xboxes and phones to do this. They're still on it. But what I'm saying is, it looks like parenting is getting worse, so you think we'd be producing worse people, but it turns out we seem to be producing better people because crime is going down.
Maybe they're looking at the parents and thinking they don't want to turn out like us.
Well, that, Jackie, has been my whole secret to life, is I have just gone, I am not going to be like you. And I often think, what would they do? Right, well, I'm going to do this then instead.
Maybe that's it.
Maybe it's the job of parents to act as a bad example for their children not to copy. And maybe that's been the secret.
But you say that. I mean, I don't smoke anymore, but I used to smoke. But it put my children off of smoking. They will never smoke because they hated me smoking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Well, let's face it, kids who start smoking, and I started smoking when I was about 14 and gave up when I was 21. But I started smoking because I wanted to be cool.
Exactly.
And I suppose having your parents do it makes it so uncool.
Well, then hopefully mine won't, you know, when they're older.
It's weird, that one.
Go out and embarrass themselves when they're, you know, on a night out and get and get ridiculously drunk and dance ridiculously badly because I think, God, my parents did that. You could have a real point there.
That might be it. That might be what's going on.
So the key then, what you're saying, is to be the worst parents you could possibly be, because your kids are going to turn out better than you are because kids
naturally want to rebel against their parents at a certain age, and if they're rebelling against things that the parents are doing that are not good things, well then that makes it a good thing, doesn't it?
Well,
it means that they'll be if they're rebelling against
psychology.
Yes, maybe that is, and that is why we have a better world with lower crime than we had 50 years ago. It's because parents are worse today. So thank you to the bad parents for making the world a better place.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. We've cracked it.
Motor racing is a great sport, but it doesn't belong on public roads. That's why people are fined and banned from driving every year in Britain for illegal road racing. The same thing would happen if you participated in any sport on a public road. But one sport is regularly seen on British highways. And over 100 people are killed every year because of it. I'm talking about cycling. People are riding push bikes on the road instead of on a track. These people are not just putting their own lives in danger. This week, a 20-year-old, Charlie Alliston, was found guilty at the Old Bailey of causing bodily harm by wanton and furious driving. Alliston was riding a bike on Old Street, East London, in February 2016. A mother of two, Kim Briggs, was crossing the road. Alliston hit her, and she suffered catastrophic head injuries and died a week later in hospital. Alliston was riding a racing bike, designed only to be used in a velodrome. It didn't have a front brake. Crash investigators, who studied CCTV of the incident, said he would have been able to stop if his bike had a front brake. You see, cyclists are delusional. They dress up like their favourite sports stars and then mimic what they do on public roads. No competitive cycling takes place on public roads because it's too dangerous for the cyclist, other road users, and pedestrians. Cycling is a sport. No sport belongs on the public highway. Cycling should be banned from our roads.
Bicycle, bicycle.
This week, a survey came out that was done by hotel workers of some of the most disturbing things they've found in hotel rooms. This included one room that they went into that was empty. All the furniture had been stolen, thrown out of the window, and then collected. What's your story of staying in a hotel that was just a little bit disturbing? Tracy.
Well, my weekend away was when I first met my husband. He took me to a place called Thirsk. He was actually doing a job for police, fitting cameras.
So that's up in Yorkshire, is it? North Yorkshire?
And basically went to this little hotel and we checked in and a man sort of popped up a bit like Basil Fawlty behind the desk and said, would you like a four-poster? And we said, no, thank you, just an ordinary room. But could we have a drink? And he said, of course, the bar's over there. So we went over to the bar. And then he popped up behind the bar with a jacket and a bow tie on. We had a drink, and then later on, he said, I said, where can we eat? And we said, we would, you know, just want a snack. We don't want anything big. He said, oh, no, you can just come through to the restaurant next door. So we went through to the restaurant next door, and he walked through with a chef hat on.
So you don't know whether he's like, you don't know whether you're in the world's best hotel with the keenest owner or the world's worst with the creepiest owner.
weirdest experience.
Sam, you've got another example of bad parenting.
When my parents used to take me on holiday when I was a kid, and I'm talking like when I was 3, 4, and 5, we'd drive either to the south of France or Cornwall. It used to vary from year to year. And Dad always had a big car anyway, like a Cortina or something like that.
Yeah.
And because it was such a long drive, they would put me in a sleeping bag on the parcel shelf.
Goodness me.
And that is where I would stay for the entire journey.
Goodness me. And how old were you?
3, 4, and 5.
So,
every year for about...
So you just looked out the back of the car the whole way?
Yeah, I was on the parcel shelf, wrapped up in a cocoon in the sleeping bag. I vaguely remember it from the last time that we did it.
Goodness me. Child protection, where were they?
No seatbelts, nothing.
Dodgy hotels. Piper, you planned a dirty weekend in Brighton with Doug.
I booked this place that I'd found on the internet, and I thought it would be all right. And, of course, we got there, and it looked quite grotty from the outside. We walked past all these really nice hotels, and we're thinking, oh, this should be okay. And then we got to this one, and it looked grotty from the outside. And we went in, and the guy behind the counter was wearing one of those string vests that Bruce Willis wears in the Die Hard movie.
Uh-huh.
And a neck brace.
Right.
And it was really surly. And we went up to the room, and it was just sort of full of furniture that you'd probably find in a junk store.
Uh-huh.
And it sort of smelt. And there was blood on the duvet.
No.
Yeah. And I just said, I don't think I can stay here. This is horrible. And I was so impressed by Doug. He was so manly. We strode down the stairs and he said, I'm sorry, but this place doesn't come up to our standards. We're leaving. And we went and found somewhere else. And I just swooned.
Wow, that is just horrific. Someone's been murdered in there.
Probably. Or maybe they just cut themselves shaving. I don't know.
I'm going with murdered. All right. Thanks a lot, Piper.
Cheers.
Bye. Let's get to my guest. It's Slim Jim Phantom, the drummer with the Stray Cats. This is part two of my chat with him. In part one, you heard how he grew up in Massapequa, Long Island, New York, learned the drums, and with Brian Setzer and Lee Rocker, they formed the Stray Cats. And as teenagers, they took a punt and got on a flight to London. So this is 1980. They were homeless for a while, living in squats. And then they started to get some gigs. And they started to get noticed.
So the word spread kind of quickly, and we got more of these kind of gigs. And we were always the opening act, or the third opening act, or at the Marquee, and then Dingwalls, and all these kind of rock clubs. And then a few labels came. It just kind of spread, and it took a few months after that. But we were the toast of the town. But we still didn't have any money or anywhere to live.
And you're 19. Your whole life had been in the USA. How big a culture shock was London itself at the time?
Well, there were good things and bad. It was mainly good. 90% good. It was the people that we had fallen in with, and just London in general. Everyone had something. Like everyone was a rocker or a mod or a Ted or a punk rocker or a rude boy and the Stray Cats being, rockabilly is kind of a cool thing across the board, and we were American, and we just thought anyone with any haircut against the squares, right? we didn't know anyone who was any look, who cared about fashion or music as a way of life. We didn't know anyone, and now everyone you knew, so we loved it.
Slip into the alley with the runaway boy.
Varying tribes loved us.
Yeah, because you had the punk attitude, but
yeah. And like, and you can't go wrong with Eddie Cochran. Everyone agrees on Eddie Cochran. I don't care
if you're a
blue boy or a punk rocker or, you know, a heavy metal guy or, you know, like whatever. I'm a gonna raise a fuss, I'm a gonna raise a holler about a working all summer just to try to earn a dollar. Every time I call my baby, try to get a date, my boss says, no dice, son, you gotta work late. Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues. Oh, well, my mom and papa told me, son, you gotta make some money. If you want to use a car to go a-riding next Sunday. Oh, well, I didn't go to work, told the boss I was sick. Now you can't use a car cause you didn't work a lick. Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues. I'm gonna take 2 weeks, gonna have a fun vacation. I'm gonna take my problem to the United Nations. Well, I called my congressman and he said, vote. I'd like to help you, son, but you're too young to vote. Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues. And then we had a bit like rock royalty, someone like Chrissie Hynde and Strummer. They were all coming, you know. So
well, that was the music that attracted them to get into the business. So for you to be coming down and doing it authentically must have just been such a thrill for the likes of, you know, Robert Plant and Ronnie Lane and people.
Well,
like
that's
that.
The thing that, and like, we didn't know it. For us, now we can say it. Look back, it was totally organic. We didn't know any of that kind of thing because it was a foreign country. But London, you might as well said Jupiter to me, like it was a foreign place. We kind of appealed to that across the board without really knowing it. And then those classic rock guys, when Ray Davies came down, and then really the guy came, well, really at the beginning quite a lot, was Jeff Beck.
Yeah.
And Ronnie Lane too. And you know, he became our friend, really. He wanted to produce the record and he was already sick by that point. It was a little bit of a sad story, but and I guess with those kind of guys, one hears about it and then it's cool, you know. And Pete Townsend came one time. And then when we went on the first tour, Robert Plant came quite a bit, like, because he lives a little bit outside of London. And so then it catches on to the mainstream at that point. Then it's not just NME or Melody Maker. Then it's the Daily Mirror writes about it kind of thing, you know.
That was big news here when I think it was all five Rolling Stones went out to see you.
Yeah, that was kind of a bit of a, you know, crazy. They had heard about it. I don't know when the last time those guys ever did anything socially, like all of them at a nightclub, at one table. I mean, try to organize five of your friends to do anything, let alone five of the most famous band ever kind of thing, you know? So, and they had a table and we were whisked off the stage and they loved it, man. Keith stood up and like knocked the ashtray over. Hey, man, that was great. You know, like the whole thing. And, you know, there's photographs of it. So that was a big thing, of course, you know. And so then we had to make a record. There was a big buzz and they wanted to do the record on their label and have them produce it. But that was very hard to capture lightning in a bottle twice to get everyone. Then it was hard to get two of them in the same room. So we met with Mick Jagger a few times at their office. And then Keith had us down to, I think Brian went, I'm not sure if we went, to his house down in the country. And again, it was, we were supposed to talk a little bit of business, but of course it was mainly partying. But we needed the business because we, like I said, we were still broke and had nowhere to live.
Yeah.
We needed to sign a record deal. It was all this interest, but we had to at some point pick one and, like, you know, start, because these things can be very ephemeral, you know what I mean? It could be out the next day kind of thing, you know, capture it while it's happening. And so it was very hard to get those guys organized a second time.
Yeah.
And at that point, we had gone with a record label, and we had met Dave Edmonds, who's really the star of the show.
I mean, he really understood the music, didn't he, Dave? And he produced that first album on Arista.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, he wound up doing a lot of this, you know, big part of your life. But and he knew what to do. He knew how to capture the sound, and he told us that he felt like Sam Phillips looking for Elvis. Like, he had a sound in his head. He's a musician, Dave. First and foremost, he's one of the best I've ever seen singing and playing, but he likes to consider himself to be a record producer more first, you know, and he was looking for some band. He knew it wasn't him that would do it, to capture that exact rockabilly, because he loved so much, capture that sound. What we called it back then was Rockabilly 2000, but that's already old now. that's how long ago we made the record. So he knew how to technically get what we had in our heads, you know?
Yeah.
And he had it in his head. Like, he had a vision of modern rockabilly music. And the other two were a little bit more skilled than me, but no one had really ever made a record. I might have gone and, you know, taped something in like a little studio once, or someone's had, you know, had some mics at the gig set up kind of thing. But like, no one had been in a studio like that before. And he was really patient, and he knew how to coax the performance out of us to not be so, you know, do it like the gig, yes, but you can't really like stand on the drum in the middle of the song, or, you know, be too crazy. Like, you have to be a little bit in control, right? So he sonically knew how to do that. He really became a very important guy for us, because if they had gone with the wrong producer, because you're young and you hot at the same time, but I don't think you would just been able to take your friend to produce the record. They might have picked you the guy that was had the last hit record. You know?
Yeah.
Whoever was the, you know, the producer that was trendy at the moment, and the record might not have sounded the same. You know, so it's a little bit of luck involved.
Listening to it today, the album still stands up. That's the great thing with the Stray Cats music. It doesn't date, because it's a genre all its own. It doesn't matter when it was recorded. You know, it's timeless. It's just great.
Yeah, that's what I think now. I mean, if Rock This Town comes on the radio, it really does sound good. Well, maybe me went out late Saturday night. I had my hair part-time and the baby just looks so right. Well, your hair pick up a 10, gotta have you over two. Mama, I don't know why I got stuck in, but that's all right, cause we're looking as cool as can be. Well, we found a little place that really didn't look half bad. it doesn't sound like an 80s record. Let's say all the other, if you go through Top of the Pops on the week that our record came out, I don't know how many of those other records stand up.
Exactly.
Some are great songs. Great songs are great songs. But sonically, it was a very specific time period. You know, technology was changing a little bit. And new stuff was coming in and old stuff was going out. Boards were, you know, solid state was trendy. I don't know if Rock This Town would sound like if it was done on a solid state. But so you have to be, I have to be grateful that it lined up. The stars lined up. Just luck of the draw, because if the record label that said, we want this produced by the guy that just did Tainted Love or something like that, you know, great records, or the, you know, whatever record was in the charts at the same exact time as ours. Usually it's a trendy producer gets jobs, you know.
Yeah.
And you would have got some guy who might have been a great producer, but did he know rockabilly from the inside out like Edmonds did, you know? Probably not. So, again, it was lucky, you know. He was available. He heard about it. He was accepted by the label. They released the money. We went in the studio. It was all a bit – all this was happening in live time. We probably had a gig that night, you know. It was probably, you know – it was all in fluid time.
And the album was huge. How did that change things then for you guys?
Well, it changed it because then we went on the road, really, which, I mean, at that point, we were basically London-centric.
Yeah.
I had played in New York, and I had played in London. That was about it, really, you know? And in London, at that point, we were trendy, so it was, you know, you could really do no wrong kind of thing. So then you had to take it on the road.
Yeah.
You don't know. Are they going to like it here? Are they going to like it there? We did a tour of England first, and it was just, you know, fantastic. 25 dates. We were in Liverpool and Glasgow and, like, places that you only thought about, you know. And that led very quickly to going to Europe, where it was a real big hit.
Yeah.
Places like, you know, especially France, it was like, I think, number one. Everything we did in France was number one, I think, the first 5-6 records. And they loved it there, the French. So to be going and being the toast of Paris, you know, was a pretty special thing. And it was the same in Amsterdam and Stockholm and Berlin. And we just again, it was like places that you had to identify on a map to pass a test in school. It's like you were actually, you know, playing there and being welcomed by the locals, not as some, you know, pain in the neck tourist, but as a, you're welcome there, you know. And and we, you know, for our part, we really worked hard. We would do a gig every night and do a TV show every day, some mime show to Runaway Boys, you know, like you'd go and we did dozens and dozens of those, and all day was interviews and TV shows and radio shows, play the gig at night, and you'd, you know, party every night at whatever, you know, party in Paris, and then you'd, you know, move along. And we did that for months and months, you know, well, it wound up being years, but like in the beginning. And then, see, because if you get a record released in England, it's released in Europe then.
Yeah, but it wasn't released in the US though, was it, that first one?
No, because every record company, every record deal has two parts to it. There's a US record deal and there's an outside US record deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, so each territory has the yay or nay to if they want to release it or not.
Yeah.
When it's their turn kind of thing, you know? So we signed without an American part of the deal. So we were touring the world and we went to Japan, Australia, Europe quite a few times, England again, like for the first couple of years. And it hadn't been released in the States because it hadn't really come up yet.
Yeah.
Then for whatever reason, you know, record companies changed. It wound up, EMI wound up taking it over
mm-hmm.
for the States. And then the worldwide thing became EMI. But this was 2 years later. So we just, and at that point in, say, Europe and Australia, Japan and England, we were at a certain level.
Yeah.
We could play a couple thousand seaters and kind of everybody knew. You'd be on the cover of the magazine if you did an interview. But the States was so vast.
Yeah.
No, still, it was not really that much more clued in. But since we had left and since we came back, MTV had started.
Okay, yeah.
And we had a couple of, usually, I think back then, you would have to put your record out. If it was getting a little bit of a buzz, then X amount of radio stations were playing it. Then the label would say, okay, we'll invest the $100,000 that it costs to make a video.
Yeah.
And see if MTV will play. It was kind of like that. So, but we had a couple, three videos in the can.
Yeah.
That we had done in England with Julian Temple, who's a big film director now and all that. But he was a guy that made videos and it was a fan, and a friend back then. So we had a couple of world class videos that they used in England and Europe for playing on TV shows when you couldn't make the gig and all that. So MTV back then, believe it or not, they needed content. They just didn't have that many videos yet. It was still a new format.
Yeah.
So we were in America in a bus just going from town to town playing clubs. And, of course, the hipsters in every town knew you'd have a few hundred people packed out in a club. But America's so big.
Yeah.
It's not like, say, Europe, where if you're getting ahead in London, it pretty much spreads quickly kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
In America, you could be doing well in New York, and like L.A. is 3,000 miles away. It's not – so you need something to link it all together. It was still very regional then. MTV was the first thing that was national. So MTV, without any investment from the record company, we already – when they bought the Stray Cats, they bought two videos already kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
So they got it to MTV, and MTV started playing it.
Right.
And that was just game over, really. We were in the middle of a tour when they started playing Stray Cat Strut on, you know, video, and every kid in America coming home after school watching that.
Tail in the air. Drink, catch, strut, I'm a feeling Casanova. Hey, Vanessa, get a shoe thrown at me from a mean old man. Get my dinner from a a garbage can.
So the album that came out, you really didn't have to do anything because Built for Speed was a compilation of the first two UK albums, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly. And we put a new track on it and a new cover and all that kind of stuff. And we just played, you know, for 2 years, whatever, straight in the States. And it built then, again, because it was good. And they got you shot on TV and then you did well on that. We did our part of it.
Yeah.
You know, and at that time, the record companies were still kind of powerful and things. So if they did their job and you did your job, everyone had a success back then, you know. But still, it was very slim odds.
Yeah.
Someone like the Stray Cats is always going to be the underdog because it's not the mainstream. And so for a few, you know, a little while there, rockabilly became the mainstream.
And how did success change things for you personally?
Well, I don't really know if anyone changes that much. I mean, never quite had a yacht or anything like that, you know. I mean, had somewhere to live.
Yeah.
And you had a little bit more stability in your life. And we were still kind of gypsy, to be honest with you. And, you know, kind of everyone is the same, really. If I think about the other two guys, and I'm sure they say the same thing about me, to when we were in school, I think everyone's kind of the same.
Did the relationship change once you became successful between the other two guys?
Well, sure. Yeah, I would think with any band, you know, just being around someone else, you know, in like a 5-foot spot on an airplane or, you know, a dressing room for 5 years in a row, everyone's going to get burnt out on it. But there was, and again, you're dealing with people in their 20s.
Yeah.
Who, you know, we said we're going to be rock stars. Yeah, sure. You know, and we are now. So, there's a certain amount of, you know, maturity that has to happen, I guess, because we were pretty crazy, you know. It was like but not bad. Like, Stray Cats were never dark.
Yeah.
It was, you know, Hard Day's Night kind of, you know, hijinks, but, you know, maybe R-rated, you know. Like, it was never, you know. But we definitely fed off the other two.
Yeah.
There was certainly on stage and off stage, and in an interview or on the gig, there was a certain chemistry with it, and everyone played off of each other's. So in that sense, it was, you know, it was very, you know, Beatley like that, I think, because we knew how to have the joke ready for the next guy to put the punchline. We had a natural way of that. And by the time we hit America, we've been doing it really for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
You know? So on that level. So change where maybe you get sick of seeing the other one a little bit. But I don't think that the, you know, how much I care for them, that really never changed.
And at the peak of your success, 1984, Stray Cats break up. What happened?
again, I think it was a culmination, and Brian wanted to make a solo record, and I didn't quite understand that, but I don't know, everyone does what they want, so he wanted to make a solo record, and then Lee and I said, well, if he's going to make one, I'm going to make one, and then it took like 2, 3, 4 years for everyone to get back together again, kind of thing, mm-hmm. you know, to like drift back together. But it was good times. We, you know, Lee and I made a record together with a guy named Earl Slick.
Yeah.
Phantom Rockers, like which like was a successful record. I don't know, it was quite gold, but it was like it did pretty good. And Keith Richard played on it, and Nicky Hopkins, the last time he played with Keith Richards, they were like reunited a little bit, which was kind of cool. And you know, you had gotten a certain status in the business where you could get in touch with Keith Richards and he would come play on your record. Pretty cool, you know. And I'm still 25 years old from Massapequa, you know, wow. And I called Keith Richards and he said yes. So that was good for everyone, that you proved a little bit to yourself and to the public that you did it outside of the band. I would have never stopped playing with the band. That's something I tell the others as well. Like, I wouldn't have done that. I'm the drummer, so I go along a little bit, you know? So, but I wouldn't have done it that way. But since we did it that way, you know, it turned out okay. And I think maybe in hindsight, those were like a major 3-4 years that we should have really been pushing the band, because it was right in the, not quite the beginning, but not quite the end yet. You know, it was like, that's when you should have been really hammering it out. But nobody knows this. That's the whole thing. You're young, and, you know, I think if you go back to any band you want to talk about, anyone, if you even mention the Beatles or the Clash or the Pistols or anyone who didn't do as much as you maybe think they should have, and you tell them, take 6 months off, take a year off.
Yeah.
Nobody, everyone, you'd still have the Sex Pistols, you'd still have the Clash, you'd still have, you know, the Beatles maybe would have made another record after Abbey Road, you know, like, take 6 months, take a year off. But at the time, you are a little bit part of a machine, and then just having to keep going, oh, well, if you're going to break up the band, well, the guy who's the main guy, he should make a solo record right now, so we can milk it. That's how it is.
Yeah.
So now, since I'm old, I know all this. You know, when I was young, nobody knows all this. So it's really kind of a similar story, I think.
But you keep getting back together. Have you any plans to get back together again?
Well, there's talk about it. That's, you know, always the rumor. And I think it all hinges around like the right offer to drape it all around and everyone's schedule. And, you know, the interest has never gone away.
Yeah.
Like, we don't sit at home trying to conjure up ways to get the band back together again. It keeps coming back to us, you know. Why don't you guys do this? There's an offer to do this. And one of these times, it's going to work. And I think we did it about 7 years ago. And we had a very, you know, like, it's always a big success because it's very unique. No one's really come along to do the same thing.
Yeah.
If there's a hard rock band and they're not playing, there's a few other hard rock bands that step into the shoes and maybe play. And if there's a, you know, a pop singer girl who's taking time off, there's another one that comes, you know. The Stray Cats, I don't really know of another rockabilly influenced group that really stepped in.
Yeah.
Certainly it hasn't had a hit record that I know about. But, you know, there's a few good ones and they play gigs, but there's no, like, headliners that have come along out of that scene.
Well, I saw you guys play in Sydney, Australia in 1990. You were amazing. You're at the Coogee Bay Hotel. The energy in the room was just incredible. I mean, I was exhausted at the end of it.
You ready for some real rock and roll? You want rock and roll like you never heard? Slim Jim, show them how to do it, baby. We'll be right back.
How do you unwind after a gig like that?
Now I'm too tired, but then used to go for it a little bit. I'm trying to. It's kind of what you do, like in a funny way. So it's I guess like a ball player. I'm not quite sure what you can really reference it to. But you know, after the gig, now you're tired. You want to go to dinner. It's like a little bit more. It's not quite the insanity that it once was. But, you know, just kind of plain old tired, I think, at this point, you know. But you know, back then, 1990, we probably still would have been going for it, you know. You know, release tension at the local hot spot of Sydney and cause a little trouble.
Go down to King's Cross, maybe. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, positively, that's what we would have done.
Yeah. Well, you've been a working musician constantly in between the Stray Cats. You mentioned working with Earl Slick. You worked with Robert Plant. You worked with Keith Richards. As well, of all of the collaborations outside the Stray Cats, which one are you most proud of?
Well, the one probably I'm most proud of is I had a long-term one with Lemmy, who was my dearest pal. You know, he and I made two albums under the band name Head Cat, and we would do tours whenever he had a break, really, because they had a brutal schedule. And we would always make time for that. And like to keep a long running one with something that's so seemingly opposite too. But part of our manifesto was have it be known that Stray Cats and Motorhead are very similar. They're not very different. You know, it's a trio. And again, if you strip it all down, it's Eddie Cochran. And, you know, he was my pal and we kept that going for a long time. So that's what I'm very proud of. Because that was really like a proper side project. You know, it was something that we did whenever we could and we're proud of it.
Down to the ground.
2007, you formed Catmen with Imelda May. How did that go?
It was really her husband, or ex-husband now, Daryl Higham, who's ace rockabilly guy. Yeah, he's as good as anybody. He and I met at a rockabilly, like a festival kind of thing, and we're just fast friends, and decided to do something together. And Imelda got involved. She's his wife, and we were doing the record at their home studio, so she was there. So you know, she could hear through the next room. So and she's very talented, and she's really, really good.
Yeah,
and she's really earned what she's got now. And because I was there when they were just starting it out, and I'm actually going to do some stuff with Daryl over the summertime. A couple festivals in Europe that I have as a trio,
Is this the Slim Jim Phantom Trio?
Yeah. And I've asked Daryl to play guitar, so it's a couple with him. So I'll see him over the summertime.
Oh well, we look forward to seeing that and catching up with you. What else is next for Slim Jim Phantom?
I did a little tribute thing for Lemmy.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Under the band name Headcat again, Danny Harvey and myself, and we've got a singer. Again, I was trying to find something. Like, it's been about a year since Lem died, and I have this thing in my head, like, I want to make a record for him. So I wrote a song called Born to Lose, Live to Win.
Yeah.
Which I just made a list of all kind of cool Lemmy stuff. Yeah. Custom-made cowboy boots, you know, playing the slot machines, you know, bullet belts and rock and roll, you know, and I made a song out of it. That's what he loved. Like, it's like a bit of a Chuck Berry kind of song with a little twist to it, which is what he loved. So I did that kind of specifically writing a song about him that I knew he would like. We enlisted a bass player named David Vincent, who's in a very famous hard rock band called Morbid Angel.
Uh-huh.
And again, to the metal kids, he's like a very well-known guy. He wasn't on my radar any more than I was on his, I don't think. But through a few people that we met, we had a mutual guy. So to get this guy, he's a Lemmy kind of character. He's like a heavy metal cowboy kind of guy, you know. So he stepped in and he sang the song and added his own bits to it. going to, part as a tribute to Lem and part to have fun, we're going to go and do a bunch of the hard rock festivals in Europe.
Yeah.
So I'll be the only rockabilly guy on, you know, a festival that's got, you know, very famous heavy metal bands on in Germany and Holland. And so, again, it's a little bit of my funny life that I'm the rockabilly guy and I can go and play on a gig that Iron Maiden is the headliner, you know. And,
yeah.
And
but the Maiden fans totally would have total respect there, yeah.
Of course, yeah. That's the thing. We've learned later, you know, as we've gone through this journey, is that rockabilly is accepted by everyone. And as like positively amongst musicians. That's why I've been able to work with someone like Keith Richards and Robert Plant and then Lemmy and then some young guys, because rockabilly is, and then the Stray Cats are very credible.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's really not just a, you know, a flash in the pan genre.
Yeah. And it's the real deal.
Rockabilly. Yeah. So,
because it's so stripped down, there's nowhere to hide in the production and effects and stuff. It's yeah. just the guitar, bass, and the stand up drums. Yeah.
Exactly. And all the guys and all the smart guys you've ever heard of in, you know, the music business know this.
Yeah.
Whether it's Iron Maiden or the Rolling Stones, everybody knows that it comes from Eddie Cochran and Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis and Buddy Holly and Chuck Berry. These guys know it. It doesn't matter what they so much sound like.
Yeah.
Everyone who's halfway smart and has made it in this business knows that.
Yeah.
So it takes you a while to kind of know that, me a while to, you know, you recognize this as you go along. So that's why I've been in a good spot, because, you know, rockabilly and then being in the, you know, what I think is the best rockabilly band ever, it leaves a few doors open. Like, oh, that's Slim Jim. Yeah, that would be a cool thing. Yeah. So it's always, you know, I'm always grateful that, you know, we formed the Stray Cats when I was 18 years old, because it's afforded you, you know, a lot of credibility.
Yeah. And you mentioned Jerry Lee Lewis there. You briefly worked with him too. What was that like? I would imagine he's a difficult guy to get close to.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever been close to him. No, we worked together quite a bit on, you know, various things over the years. I've toured in his band a little while, did some recording with him, did like a what's now like a classic TV show with him. Yeah, he was a character. I don't know if I've ever had a conversation with him or if I've ever really hung out with him. I don't know if he does that with anyone.
Yeah.
But, you know, a couple times you get a look from him and it's like, you know that you're doing the right thing.
Right.
You're on stage and he, you know, he would have the drums right behind the piano player, really close to him. And every now and again, he'd give you that killer look,
yeah.
You know, that you knew you were doing something right. And, you know, 1,000 words were spoken. So, and I speak to his family. I know his son, Lee, Jerry Lee III, he, you know, he and I are in touch, and he says, you know, Dad loves you, talks about you. So it's, you know, it's totally a part of my life that I'm, can be proud of, that you got close to a guy like that, you know, musically.
Well, it completes the circle, doesn't it? Because you guys were inspired by the music from Sun, and Jerry Lee is, as his album said, he is the last man standing from the Million Dollar Quartet, and it just brings it all together, you know? I just think that's brilliant.
Thank you.
Yeah, I always go back to like when I was 17 years old, walking to my drum lesson, and you would stop me at the crossroads and say, 40 years later, you're going to have played with Jerry Lee, toured with the Stones, lived in London, hung out with the rock royalty in London, and like been able to go. Still, I can go anywhere in London. I know London like the, you know, taxi driver, you know, to go, and I'm pretty much welcome everywhere. And sign this in blood. Will you take this life right now? Of course. Right. So,
yeah.
So that's what I, you know, wanted to. I always wanted to travel, and London's a very special place for me. I still go quite a lot, and we had a house there for quite a while. And you know, now I have a wealth of friends. I can either stay with Glenn in Maida Vale, or I can go stay with Pete Golding in Chelsea, or I can go stay with my friend Scottish Gary in Knightsbridge. I've got my kind of choice of you know, Tony areas in London that I can go and stay with one phone call. And of course, you take the deal.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? And you've got the respect from those people. We had Glenn on the show not long ago, and Glenn did talk.
Oh, Glenn's my best buddy.
He talked very fondly about working with you. And
yeah, he's my guy, you know.
So, Slim Jim Phantom, thank you so much for your time today. Congratulations once again on the book. The book is called A Stray Cat Struts My Life as a Rockabilly Rebel. Slim Jim Phantom, thank you so much.
Well, thanks, Trev. Just stay in touch anytime, buddy. Now you got my number.
Brilliant.
I talk to everybody all the time.
I'll do that. Cheers, Jim. It makes me cool.
Okay. You got it. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you. Well, that's it for this one. Hope you can join me for the next one. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on Apple Podcasts. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. Put your phone number in the email. I might call you back. I might Skype you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk, and you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next time. Ta-da.